At the heart of Americans' fear of black men is an ugly stereotype, the black criminal. It's a toxic and remarkably persistent stereotype, but where did it come from? Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad traces some of our current attitudes about race and crime back to the late 19th century, when early sociologists first began looking at crime statistics. He tells Steve Paulson how the archetype of the black criminal emerged after slavery.
So you've got 4 million people who had in a historical blink of the eye gone from being enslaved to free. And the question was, how do they fit? What are they capable of? What is the quality of their contribution to society? And it just so happened this was a moment for the emergence of what we think of as sociology today, or more generally, the social sciences. So there was a lot of focus on demographics and health and mortality rates and essentially ranking various groups, largely European immigrants, like African Americans, into categories of fitness, what kinds of contributions would they make? So that was the larger context in which this question of criminality emerged.
So there were crime statistics that were used to promote this idea of black criminality.
Yes, but more particularly, it wasn't obvious that that would be the signpost for black people's fitness in modern life. A couple of innovative demographers noted that African Americans were disproportionately represented in the nation's prisons one generation after slavery. The number was roughly 30% of 82,000, and that number represented a nearly three times overrepresentation of African Americans, who were only 12% of the general population.
This sounds like a very familiar story today.
It is a very familiar story. And what's interesting about it is, while we know what that means to a lot of people, back then, someone had to explain it. Someone had to make meaning of it. And it was in that origins moment, the use of crime statistics in the U.S. Census, one generation after slavery, particularly the 1890 census, did we set in motion a set of ideas that are in circulation today and essentially justify certain forms of discriminatory treatment, both explicitly within our criminal justice systems as well as in general society.
Well, you write about this association between blackness and criminality as, to some degree, the work of a demographer named Frederick Hoffman. Why was he so significant?
He's really the first person to make a big deal about this. He's the first person to look at the U.S. Census data in 1890, see the disproportionate rates of African Americans in prisons at that time, and write about it in such a way that others took note, and he started a trend. And that trend essentially said that in the aftermath of slavery, crime statistics among African Americans prove that they are, one, inferior, two, retreating or reverting to an ancestral state closer to savagery than to citizens, and should be subjected to different standards of justice as a result.
So he had a whole, he didn't just talk about the statistics, he had this whole racist interpretation of them.
Well, it would be easy to call it racist today, because then we could dismiss him to the dustbin of history. He was actually incredibly innovative. What made him innovative and what made his argument stick and be so transformative and significant even to this day was that he made the argument using what we would recognize today as a kind of post-racial logic. He made the case that the crime statistics were actually race-neutral or colorblind. Hoffman said, well, the statistics literally speak for themselves. We can just see, what do they do when given a chance to participate in society? Oh, they turn out to be a bunch of criminals.
So how should those crime statistics have been used, have been interpreted? I mean, if sociologists really knew what they were doing.
Looking back, we could say that turns out a significant number of African Americans were subject to new forms of racial surveillance and social control. In other words, that 30% number would have a gigantic asterisk or footnote attached to it saying, we have no idea how much racism there was in the 1870s and 80s that produced this number, but we know it was a whole lot. Therefore, this number can't be taken at face value. The other thing that actually happened in that moment was you had significant rates of homicide, crimes of poverty and property, underground participation in drug markets by European immigrant groups, largely Italians, Irish, Polish, Catholics, their crime statistics were through the roof in many cities. And people we come to know as progressives, those who were essentially liberals, arguing that inequality was the basis for social disorder in the nation's leading cities at the time, explained the crime statistics.
So the difference there was black people were considered as sort of innately violent, whereas there were kind of environmental reasons why these white immigrants committed crimes.
That's right. The footnote, there was a gigantic footnote attached to the European immigrants' crime and none attached to African Americans. One spoke for itself. The other one had a very long explanation.
Now, there were critics back then of Hoffman's work. W.E.B. Du Bois was a big critic of his research, wasn't he?
Du Bois was the first African American to really gain status as a national expert on the black urban condition and race in general. He actually writes in an 1898 article on the study of the American Negro a response to Hoffman's work because he sees it as incredibly dangerous. He describes Hoffman as essentially doing drive-by sociology, that no foreigner can simply look at census data and put his finger on the pulse of a problem. Hoffman was a German immigrant who arrived in the United States in 1884.
Of course, the other side of this whole discussion of criminality is how it plays out in law enforcement and policing, a subject that is on everyone's mind these days. Are there parallels to what was going on back then?
It would be impossible not to find a moment if you read the daily newspapers of Philadelphia, of Chicago, of New York, of Cleveland and Detroit, and not see stories that sound identical to the problem of stop and frisk today, or even the idea of broken windows, that is, policing low-level status offenses. When black people stepped outside of the prescribed areas, they were subjected to forms of heavy-handed, often brutal policing that sent a message that you are out of place, you are not welcome here. So the form of policing that evolved in the North evolved not only in direct relationship to these ideas articulated through crime statistics, but also through the way in which the city itself evolved in the North, which was very different than what segregation looked like in the South.
So the kinds of questions about inequality that we're dealing with today, racial profiling, sort of differences in the length of sentencing, were those talked about back then as well?
Only to a degree, and it took time. So by the late 1920s, the work of people like Du Bois or Ida B. Wells, people like that helped to reshape the debate among American criminologists, white criminologists like Edwin Sutherland and Thorsten Sellin, who were two of the leading criminologists of the period. They were swayed by the arguments of their black counterparts, and they too noted excessive police activity in the black community amongst innocent people. They noted disproportionate sentencing of African Americans for crimes that whites similarly engaged in, and began to call crime statistics a legal fiction or evidence of the legal fictions of equality. That was a significant breakthrough in the late 1920s and early 1930s.
So you're saying that there were critics of the criminal justice system, of policing procedures, of African Americans being targeted going back at least a century, which does raise the question, why hasn't there been more progress since then?
Well, sometimes beliefs trump data, meaning that it didn't matter that you had counter evidence. Can I give you a really good example?
Sure.
In the 1922 report of the Negro in Chicago, it was one of the first Blue Ribbon commissions to study the outcome of a race riot. What they found was not only that there was so much racism in the criminal justice system that crime statistics were essentially useless, but they also had direct testimony from judges, from police officers, from district attorneys, all whites, saying that when we come across African American suspects, we treat them differently because we are afraid that if we don't control them, we'll lose track of them. In other words, we keep a close eye on them and we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. So this was a major admission within a major sociological report on a major riot in a major city, Chicago, over 100 years ago, and it made very little long-term difference.
So let's bring this story up to the present now. You know, huge national debate about all of these issues that we've been talking about. Is there something new going on right now, or are we just replaying the story that you've been describing that goes back at least 100 years?
It's a little bit of both. So on one hand, there is a long tradition of fighting racial violence, if we think of it in the broadest sense, whether it's by an individual citizen or by a police officer. What we did not see, however, was that the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s did not make attacking racism in the criminal justice system as a core pillar of its work, which is to say what we are potentially seeing is the first national movement directed explicitly to the criminal justice system as a civil rights movement, not about racial violence, but about criminal justice.
Now, we've been talking about this really depressing history, frankly, of, you know, how a lot of these problems we're very aware of today go way back, and people talked about them back then. It does raise the question of what can we do?
Well, we start telling a different story of who we are as a nation. We've never really come to terms with our racial legacy. We treat it as an aberration. But the truth is that America can't be America without having had slavery. So these are things that your listeners are already saying, what does that have to do with changing the circumstances of today? But that's precisely the point. We have a deep aversion to a full reckoning with our history. And it doesn't have to make us feel bad, but it is the necessary precondition for holding ourselves accountable when we do slide into the past from the present and start to see things that are far too eerily familiar. So education and how we teach matters greatly to this.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. He's also the author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America.